Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. On February 14th, 1989, Valentine's Day, Salman Rushdie was telephoned by a BBC journalist and told that he had been sentenced to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini. For the first time, he heard the words fatwa, his crime to have written a novel called The Satanic Verses, which was accused of being against Islam, the Prophet, and Quran. How do a writer and his family live with the threat of murder for more than 9 years? How does he go on working? How does he fall in and out of love? How does despair shape his thoughts and actions? How and why does he stumble? How does he learn to fight back? In his new memoir, Joseph Anton, Rushdie tells that story for the first time, the story of one of the crucial battles in our time for freedom of speech. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sir Salman Rushdie to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
When you consider this project, I assume there was an initial reluctance to write about it and to re-immerse yourself into something that you have been removed from somewhat for almost a decade.
Well, yeah, more than a decade, really. I mean, one of the reasons why the book's only being written now is that for a very long time, the last thing on earth I wanted to do was to revisit that dark time. I just wanted to get away from it and write my novels and stories and, you know, go back to being the person I'd always wanted to be until this derailed me, so to speak. But I always knew that I would write it. I mean, all the time that this was going on, I kept a journal because I thought to myself, you're never going to remember this, write it down. Mm-hmm. You're going to forget the dailiness of it, you know. And I also felt increasingly that there was something almost novelistic about what had happened to me, that, you know, my life had, unfortunately, acquired many of the characteristics of a novel. I mean, it had a storyline, it had drama, it had all kinds of things. It had, you know, spies and secret policemen and terrorists, and, you know, all kinds of things that one might find in certain kinds of novel anyway. And it became more and more my feeling that I should try and write it novelistically, that I should try and give it some of the shape and drama of a novel. Mainly in a way because of my idea of character. I felt that I wanted, when people read it, to feel that the people it was writing about, you know, came off the page and became vivid in the way that characters in a good novel do, so that you cared about them. You know, because I think that's what the novel does. It allows you to enter into a kind of relationship with the characters in the novel so that you then are affected by what happens to them. These are all real people. You know, this is me and my friends and my family and protectors. And yet I wanted them, I couldn't assume that they would automatically become vivid to the reader. You know, I had to actually use the techniques of the novel to do that. And I thought in that case, if I could make that work, then people will care. Because after all, this happened a long time ago. You know, this happened 23 years ago. Particularly a lot of younger readers would think of this as being ancient history. You know, I mean, if you were, say, 30 now, this would have happened when you were 6. And how deeply would you be affected by it anymore? So I thought the way of making it real to people is to tell that human story with the skill of the novelist and draw people in, make them care about the people to whom this happened, make them wonder, what would it be like if this happened to my family, if this happened to me, if this happened to my children? How would we react? What do we think about how the people in this story react? You know, to draw people in as a writer, as a novelist does.
In that novelistic fashion, was there ever a disconnect for you between the novelist Salman Rushdie and the character Joseph Anton?
Well, it was almost a deliberate disconnect. You know, I mean, I wanted to separate myself, the person writing the book, a little bit, you know, like separate myself by like one step from the person I was writing about, because I wanted to have a proper objectivity about all the people in the book, but most of all, in a way, about myself, because I think one of the dangers of a memoir can be that it reads like self-justification, that it reads like making excuses for yourself, you know? And I think nobody really wants to read hundreds of pages about somebody telling you how great they were. It was important as sort of going in for me. I told myself that you actually have to be as critical as possible about yourself. In a way, you have to be generous about everyone else. You have to be compassionate about other people that you're writing about, but tough on yourself, because I think then people will see at least that there's an effort to tell the truth, the kind of unvarnished truth, you know, in which the protagonist, let's say me, is seen faults and all. And I think I very much wanted to go into it in that spirit.
We certainly do see you, faults and all. And before we go into that, just Joseph Anton came from...
Well, it was a name I was asked to... The police asked me to come up with a pseudonym that they could use for various purposes. And in the end, I constructed a name out of the first names of Conrad and Chekhov. So Joseph Conrad, Anton Chekhov became Joseph Anton. And there was a sort of reason for that. Chekhov, I felt, is the great writer of... the great poet, you could say, of isolation, loneliness, of kind of yearning for a brighter place that you're not living in anymore. You know, and sometimes I felt like one of his three sisters yearning for a lost Moscow. And so I thought that was appropriate. And Conrad, there's a line in Conrad which had affected me a great deal, where in one of his stories, a sailor dying of TB aboard ship is asked by one of his shipmates, you know, why did he come on the boat if he knew he was sick? You know, and he answers this wonderful, famous line. He says, "I must live till I die, mustn't I?" And I thought that thought, "I must live till I die," became for me a kind of motto.
You talk about how the fatwa was to you a jail, but to many on the outside it seemed...
almost glamorous.
Glamorous.
Yeah.
You write in the book, the longer it lasted, the longer he went without being killed, the easier it was for people to believe that nobody was trying to kill him and that he wanted the protection around him to satisfy his vanity, his insufferable self-importance. It was hard to convince people that from where he was standing, the protection didn't feel like movie stardom. It felt like jail. Yeah. At what point did you find a shift in the sense of being in isolation and yet feeling the reverberations outside of a public perhaps getting restless of you being protected?
I mean, just, you know, even in the within a few months, really, I think nobody thought that this was going to last a long time. I mean, the police didn't think it. I don't think the media thought it. I mean, I didn't think it. We all assumed that some kind of diplomatic and political solution would quickly be found, because how could it be the case in the late part of the 20th century that the head of one state would order the murder of the citizen of another state who was happily living in his own country? You know, so we all thought this was something for which would be fixed. And as time passed and it was not fixed and the situation remained grave and we were still being told that this was highly dangerous and so on, there was a certain growing skepticism amongst sections of the media, amongst some political leaders, and even gradually in the general public opinion. You know, people began to think, well, it can't be that bad because he's not dead. You know, so the odd thing was that because I wasn't dead, people began to believe that nobody was trying to kill me. But meanwhile, elsewhere, terrible attacks were taking place. You know, and there was an attack on two of my translators in Italy and Japan, and my Japanese translator, Professor Igarashi, was actually murdered. There was my Norwegian publisher, William Nygaard, was shot three times in the back, and by a miracle survived. And the point about these is these were all professional hits. These were not like random crazies. You know, it's quite clear from the methodology and the professionalism of the people involved that these were hired assassins. These were not just random people. So this were, and meanwhile, in the world of books, I mean, I've always thought that the front line of this whole affair was the bookstore. And if you look around the world, there were just terrifying attacks on bookstores. I mean, there were, Cody's bookstore in Berkeley, California was firebombed with a pipe bomb. There were two bookstores in London that were firebombed. There were, and elsewhere in the world, there was in Australia, even in Australia, there were similar things. And even leaving aside bombings. There were any number of reports from bookstores in those days of people walking into the store on almost on a daily basis and menacing employees in the store for stocking the book. And I must say, one of the great things of those years is the way in which people working at bookstores successfully held the line. People did not chicken out. You know, people did not buckle under that kind of pressure, frightening as it must have been, and often responded with colossal courage. So I would get letters from bookstores saying, you know, such and such thing had happened to their store last week, you know, a bomb had been thrown, a brick had been thrown, whatever, and their response was to display the book more prominently, you know, to put it in the window. And I think that's one of the best things about this story, how well people behaved.
And in the story, it seems that in some cases, the courage that was displayed by those booksellers was even more so than your own publishers.
Sometimes it was, sometimes it wasn't. I mean, again, you know, the book was published in a lot of countries. And in some countries, publishers behaved with great probity, dignity, moral strength, and so on, and other places not so much. And I mean, just the publishing history of the novel is a thing worth telling because it's an adventure in free speech, you could say. And then there's other things sort of that I wanted to tell, because one of the things I would say to friends in those days was that if this whole business was not totally unfunny, there are bits of it that would be very funny. And we were constantly being struck by these moments of black comedy. You know, and one of the things that I've noticed amongst the early readers of the book is a very popular moment, is a moment in which the police persuaded me that if I would wear a wig, I would become completely unnoticeable. They said, you know, you don't have to do much. You know, we know this because we're experts at this, they said. All you have to do is change some small aspect of your appearance, and you can walk down the high street and nobody will look at you. And I got sort of fooled into believing this. And so there's this one time when I put on this absurd wig that they had made for me. And I said, let's go take the wig for a walk. You know, and we went to central London, to Knightsbridge, just near Harrods. And I remember getting out of the car and people on the sidewalk actually began laughing out loud and pointing. It's like, look, who's there, he is in a wig. You know? I never wore the wig again. I mean, I've always thought that one of the great pieces of black comedy of this whole thing was that the closest I ever came to being actually killed in these years was when I was in Australia at the end of a book tour, and I had agreed to stay on and spend Christmas with a writer friend of mine in rural southern Australia, southeastern Australia, and was driving there with my wife Elizabeth and my teenage son, and we were hit in a small village. We were hit by a truck, and it turned out that this was a truck full of fertilizer, so I was literally hit by a truckload of dung. And I mean, if that wasn't funny enough, when the police showed up, they started interrogating this poor Australian truck driver for his connections to Islamic radicalism and what did he know about Al-Qaeda and so on. And he didn't know who the hell I was, but he was being accused of terrorism. He was just a bad driver.
When you were writing the book, that five-year process of writing the book.
The Satanic Verses, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
Was it... Did it cross your mind that this would be a challenge to get published? Did it cross your mind that in some way this would be considered an attack on Islam?
No, I mean, it didn't. And the fact is that not only that, but I actually took the precaution of showing it to before publication, before I'd even offered it for publication. I showed it to various friends of mine, very expert in these things, like, for example, the great... scholar Edward Said, Palestinian scholar Edward Said. I said, you know, we just read it and tell me what you think, you know. And he said, he felt, as I felt, that yes, there would be some conservative voices who wouldn't like it. But, you know, so be it, frankly, you know. And I certainly didn't have anybody telling me that they thought it would be, you know, dangerous or etc. And indeed, Well, here's a great irony that when the book came out, English language, the one or two English language bookstores that there are in Tehran, imported copies of it. And the reason is that my previous novel, Shame, had actually been given a prize in Iran for the best novel published in English, translated into Farsi that year. And so the bookstore owners thought, oh, well, you know, he's okay because they gave him a prize. You know? So they imported lots of copies of the English language edition of the Satanic Verses. And this was September 1988, which is when the book first came out in England. This is 6 months before the Khomeini fatwa. And for those 6 months, the book was freely sold in Tehran without occasioning any problem at all. I mean, no protests at all. So not even in Iran did people know that it was going to be a problem until 6 months later.
How did you, I was reading in the introduction about how you found out, but at what point did you know what this meant for your life? As you noted earlier, you certainly didn't think it would go on for as long as it went on. But no. But what is the definition of a fatwa in the sense of what its beginning, middle, and end?
Well, the word fatwa just means an edict. It doesn't necessarily automatically mean a death edict. You know, this was actually very unusual. I mean, but the truth is that the problem was not so much the fatwa itself, the words. It was much more that the Iranian state was in the habit of carrying out assassinations abroad, you know, and had people in its employ who were good at doing that. So it wasn't the fatwa itself, it was the determination of the Iranian state to carry it out. That was what was dangerous. And that became evident quite quickly. I mean, I would have said there was about a week or so after it began when there were pretty frenzied diplomatic and political efforts to try and resolve this and have them withdraw the threats. And it was about a week, I can't remember exactly, 7 or 8, 8 or 9 days later maybe, that it became clear that those efforts had not succeeded. And that was the point at which the police said to me that this was now a kind of indefinite problem. They couldn't see the problem coming to an end. And I think they were quite depressed about that. I don't think they particularly thought they were taking on a long-term problem. Mm. I was certainly depressed about it because I didn't want to be taking on a long-term problem. But it, you know, from that moment to the end of the story, it was about 11 years.
And in that end of the story, were you confident that indeed it was the end?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things about that. One is that I had come to the conclusion years before that there's no such thing as 100% security. You know, it just doesn't exist for any of us, frankly. We could walk out the door across the street and be hit by a truck. There's no guarantee that life will proceed calmly. I also thought that if I was going to wait for somebody to tell me now it's absolutely fine, that day would never come. So there's a point at which you have to make judgments of your own. Having said that, I did come to have great confidence in and belief in the British, not just the British police, but also the British intelligence services, as being really good at their job. And at the point at which they lowered the assessment of the threat against me to a level at which protection would not normally be offered and explained to me why that was so, I actually accepted that and I thought that they were probably right. And I mean, as you know, this was 10 and a half years ago, and as it turns out, you know, they have been right.
You write about your security detail, quote, "He quickly learned that there was a wide gulf between the officers in the field and the higher-ups at the yard. Those with you wanted to assist you. They wanted you to go to the movies. They wanted you to play with your son. They wanted you to be a father."
Yes, they did. They were very attentive to my human needs, let's say, you know, and they understood that this was, I mean, several of them said to me, you know, we couldn't stand what you're having to go through. And so they had also had that great sympathy for fellow human being, as one of them said, in a hell of a jam. And I've always remembered with great affection the extent to which they went to help me to be a father, to just sort of occasionally get out of the cage. some of the senior officers, not all, some of the kind of senior officers of Scotland Yard had a different view and were basically of the view that I should just be kept locked up and not allowed out much. One of the strange things about the other end of the story, when it ended and when I was talking to even the senior officers at the Yard, one of them said to me, you know, I think we restricted you too much. I think that, you know, we put you under too great a hardship. And I must say, I thought, well, thanks a lot. Now you tell me, you know, this is after a decade of my life has gone by. And I think one of the reasons is that we didn't know exactly how great the attack was going to be, you know, so extreme precautions were taken, which maybe in the end, you know, didn't need to be, but they were.
Was there a cause and effect of what happened to you and the turbulence of your personal life?
You know, actually, I think the answer to that is no. I mean, I think I don't want to blame the Ayatollah Khomeini for what happened to my marriage. I mean, I think that not many things are, I would say, were his fault, but this probably wasn't. I mean, my marriage to Marianne Wiggins, who I was married to when this all started, was already pretty much on the rocks, you know, and I think was unlikely to have survived. And after that, you know, I was, through incredible good fortune, met somebody, a publishing editor, friend of a friend, who became an incredibly staunch, loyal, sort of loving companion. So that for much of those years, most of those years, I actually did have love in my life. And then she became the mother of my younger child. And I mean, subsequently, it's true that our marriage ended, but we've remained extremely close friends. And, you know, we talk to each other every day, more or less. And she's still probably the most important woman in my life still.
When you consider the story and in writing about it, was there a very clear conclusion for you?
Well, there's two sides of the story. There's the private and the public side. I think in terms of private life, I felt that, yes, I had gone through this ordeal. And for me, the big story there was the way in which I was supported by my friends, the way in which a whole group of people who were very close to me really both practically and emotionally brought me through this. And so the great conclusion that I drew from that was a lesson about the power of friendship, you know, and that is one of the great positives that I take away from this. On the public side, you know, I'm a little uncertain. I mean, there's a section near the end of the book where I ask this question about, should we think of this as a victory or a defeat? And I think if you look at the narrow picture, the attack on the Satanic Verses and its author and publishers and so on, I think we didn't do so badly. You know, I think we defended the book, we defended ourselves, and, you know, the book is still available and so is the author. And so you could say that that's a success, you know. I think there's a larger issue, which is the fear engendered, you know, not just by this episode, because now, of course, we have many episodes in which have led people to be fearful of radical Islam, you know. And I think that fear is still very much there and has a kind of chilling effect. And I think it is harder now to publish work which is even mildly critical of Islam. And that is a long-term problem that we're going to have to overcome.
Again, the difference between Salman Rushdie and Joseph Anton.
Yeah.
The name of the book is Joseph Anton. It is published by Random House. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the book show.
Thank you. Very good to be here.
My delight. Sir Salman Rushdie is the author of Joseph Anton. It is published by Random House. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.